Okay, good morning to all. This is Pinchas Hayman broadcasting from the Columbus, Ohio International Airport. I'd like to welcome all of our participants from Canada, from the United States, from England, and from Israel, and from other places unknown. And we will be continuing this morning with our study of the third parak of Kiddushin this on the Rivadim sheets that you've all received, Sugya number 4. I would just like to say for 1 minute before we begin, for those of you that are joining us for the first time, that the purpose of these study sessions is to concentrate on the structure of the Sugya. There are many ways to study a sugya when one is studying Gemara. One can study them from the point of view of the Gaonim and the Rishonim. One can study them with different shitot of analysis, such as Pilpul, or such as the method from Brisk. But our method and our purpose is to look at the structure of the sugya itself. We don't examine Rishonim to a great extent. We're trying to understand how the application of the Rivadim method to the sugyot enlightens us as to the history of a sugya and its format, its structure, and its direction. And the way that we do this is by looking at the sugya as an entire unit, dividing it into components of Tanaim, of Amoraim, and of the Stamadra Gemara, what we call today the Shakta Vitaria. And in this way, we attempt to discover the relationships between them and the order in which the sugya was developed. Now, if you'll take a look at sugya number 4, it begins with the Mishnah, which says, Ha'omer la'isha, hare'at mikudeshali, amenat she'etin lach matayim zuz, harezu mikudeshet, vehu yiten. That if a man says to a woman, you are betrothed to me on the condition that I will give you 200 zuz, then she is mikudeshet, and he will give. He will give her. And the Mishnah, of course, is ambiguous because it's unclear what it means, vehu yiten. Vehi mikudeshet, harezu mikudeshet, vehu yiten. Does this mean that we consider the woman to be mikudeshet immediately and that the mikadesh must give her the 200 zuz in the future at some point, defined or undefined? Or do we say that she is mikudeshet when he gives her, and that the formula here is a conditional statement? You are mikudeshet to me if and when I give you the 200 zuz. The Mishnah therefore is ambiguous, and at the beginning of our sugya, we have immediately an Amoraic comment on our Mishnah. It's structured as an independent memra, beginning with the word itamar, which means it was said. And we have a machloket here between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Rav Huna is saying, vehu yitain, and Rav Yehuda is saying, lichesha yitain. Vehu yitain, meaning that the woman is mekudeshet now, but the man is obligated to give her the 200 zuz at some point in the future. Or Rav Yehuda is saying, lichesha yitain, when he gives her the 200 zuz, that she's not mekudeshet until he gives her the money before. Now, it is not clear from the actual structure of these statements that we're dealing here with a machloket, because a machloket is generally would be done as follows: Amar Rav Huna, the Rav Yehuda Amar. That would indicate that Rav Yehuda is responding to Rav Huna, but we don't have that structure here. We have Rav Huna Amar, and then Rav Yehuda Amar. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves, is this a machloket, or is it only a perceived machloket? The Gemara, as we're going to see, certainly understands this as a machloket. It analyzes it that way. It's the assumption of all the Rishonim as well that it's a machloket. So we have to assume, according to our Masorah, that it is a machloket. And just note the fact that the Memra is structured in a way other than the normal structure for machloket. In any event, you'll note that the Memrot are in Hebrew, even though the Amoraim are Babylonian, and Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda were friends. They learned under Rav together. They're second generation Babylonian Amoraim. Rav Huna is the Rosh Hashiva in Sura, and Rav Yehuda the Rosh Hashiva in Pumbedita. Now, after these lines of Machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, the next Amoraic piece in the Sugya doesn't come for several more lines when we're told that a similar Mishnah appears in Gittin, in Masachet Gittin, that deals with divorce. And there it says, Ha'omer la'isha, harei ze gitech, al menat shetitni li matayim zuz, harei zu migureshet v'hi titen. The man says to woman, this is your get on the condition that you give me 200 zuz, then she is migureshet, and she will give. And again, we have the same ambiguity. Because does this mean she is migureshet immediately with the receipt of the get, but she must give him the money in the future? Or does this mean that she is migureshet, she is considered divorced, only if and when she gives him the money that she has agreed to give? And on that Mishnah from Gittin, we have the following Memra. Itamar, it was said, Rav Huna Amar Vihi Titein, Rav Yud Amar Lichashit Titein. Rav Huna says, she will give him the money, meaning she's Megureshet now, and she must give him the money in the future. Rav Yehuda Amar Lechashe Yitein. Rav Yehuda says she's not Megureshet, the get is not effective, until she gives him the money that was agreed upon. And you will note that the two Itamars are exactly the same, with the normal grammatical differences that in the first case we're dealing with Hu Yitein, and in the second case, He Titein. But other than those grammatical peculiarities, the main road are exactly the same. We have the same Amuraim. We have the same remarks. They're consistent in their deot. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves, is this one sugya or is it two sugyot? If you had time during the week to prepare for this sugya and you opened up Masechet Gittin to this Mishnah, you'll note that the sugya there is structured exactly like ours. It's a mirror image. It starts with Gittin and brings the machloket Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, and then the Stamma de Gemara analyzes it the way it does here. We're going to get to the Stamma in a few minutes. And then the Gemara there says, and we have a similar Mishnah by Kiddushin, and the Mishnah which is brought here is brought there with the argument between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. In other words, the two Mishnayot are exactly the two sukkot are exactly the same. Now, we have to ask in a case like this, technical support is asking, what is the link to the text? I don't know. It was put onto the Torah in Motion website, and I have no idea where it is exactly. But maybe one of you can send it by email to the participant who doesn't have it. In any event, we have to ask ourselves whether these are two separate sukkot or whether they're one sukkot. One sugya. And if it's one sugya, then what we have here is the phenomenon of what's called transfer sugyot. And this deserves a few sentences of explanation as a point of method for those of you that are not familiar with it. You know, there are many, many cases in the Bavli where a specific sugya will appear in numerous places. We're not talking about the fact that a memra will be brought down in one place and quoted by the Stamma de Talmudah in another place. That's also very, very common. We're talking about the fact that there are whole sugyot that might be 5 lines, 10 lines, or even a full page, which will repeat themselves in other places in the Gemara. And I've often been asked the question, does this mean that the Amoraim said the sugya more than once? And the answer is, of course not. They said it only once, and it was in a certain place, and then copyists, for whatever reason, transferred the sugya to other places, so that now it appears in several places. When this happens, we need to examine all the places where it occurs, and then to see which location of the sugya, and what are the places to which it has been transferred, and what is the reason for the transfer in each circumstance. Sometimes the transfer can be because of similar individuals in the place to which it's transferred. There are similar Amoraim speaking, and so they transfer the sugya because it's another example of an argument between them. Or it could be conceptually it's relevant to the other place. Could be many reasons. And in response to Yisrael Kashkin's question from Passaic, who is doing the transferring, the answer is copyists, sofrim, ma'atikim. What happened is, on a manuscript, a certain Rishon or a Gaon would place a notation in the margin referring the learner to another place where this where a certain sugya occurs, and the next copyist will see the notation as an instruction to copy the sugya to here. And so the sugya now appears in two places, and this will multiply. We have sugyas that appear in five places, six places. So this concept of transfer sugyot is very important because in order to understand a sugya, you need to know its original context. So this is a general rule. Whenever you find a sugya occurring in more than place, you ask yourself, where is its original location, to where it has been transferred, and why? Now, in our situation, here in Kiddushin, with the parallel sugya in Gittin, we need to ask ourselves, is this a transfer sugya? If it is, where was it original? And where was it transferred to? Or shall we say that in this instance, in both cases it's original, and Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda argued in both places, and they're consistent in their opinions, but the sugya really has a dual head. It's not a single-headed sugya which appears many places, but it actually appeared twice. So do we have any opinions on this from all the participants here? Do we have any opinions on whether it's a double or whether it's a single sugya transferred, and why? Please answer with your mics on or through the chat room. I'm waiting for a couple of responses. No responses? No one has anything to say about this? Yes, when Yisrael Kashkin asks, are you referring to the part about he will give? Yes, that is the Mimra, the Itamar. Is it a transfer, or was it set in two places? And Byron says from Toronto, it's not a transfer, meaning that it was set in two places. I would tend to agree with Byron from Toronto that this is, and Yisrael also says he would think it's not a transfer. I would agree, because it seems to me that the comment is equally needed in both cases. As the Gemara itself is going to say in just a minute, there's a reason why it had to be brought in two places. It's not just a transfer. And they are distinct issues, as Yisrael says. Now, these two Memrot, the one brought here on the Mishnah in Kiddushin and the one brought in the Mishnah on Gittin, are the only Amoraic components that we have in the Sugya. And if we take a look now at the Stama components, the Shakta Vatsarya, let's see what they are adding. Component number two in our sugya explains the opinions of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Rav Huna, reading now component number two. Rav Huna amar vehu yiten, tana'a have, mekayem tana'a ve'azel. Rav Huna holds vehu yiten, meaning that it's a tana'i. He has to fulfill his tanai as he goes, but the fulfillment of the tanai does not hold up the effectivity of the kiddushin. The kiddushin is effective now, and he has to give the money at some future date. Whereas Rav Yehuda Amar lichashi yitain lechiyahev havu kiddushe hashtamiha lo havi kiddushe. That Rav Yehuda would hold that it's only lichashi yitain, that she's mikudeshet only when he gives the money. And that when he gives the money, they are kiddushin. But now, never, however, there is no kiddushin. And then the Gemara asks, "My binayu, what is actually the difference? What is the nafkamina, the practical differentiation between these two opinions?" And the Gemara answers in component 3-bet, "Ika binayu, what is between them is shapashtayada v'kibla kiddushin me'acher. If after he said to her, here is your kiddushin on the condition that I give you 200 zuz. And before he gave her the 200 zuz, she extended her hand and received kiddushin and money from another gentleman. The Rav Huna lo havi kiddushin. The Rav Yehuda havu kiddushin. According to Rav Huna's opinion, these would not be kiddushin because she's considered mikudeshet to the first man from the time he makes the offer. And he has the obligation to give her the money, but she's already tied to him. Whereas Rav Yehuda would say that since she's not mikudeshet until he gives her the money, that she is still free and is able to accept kiddushin from whomever she wishes. And this would be the nafkamina between the shitot of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. And then we have the itmar from Gittin. And in component number six, So in component number 7, the Gemara goes through exactly the same exercise on Gittin. Component number 6 says, Rav Huna Amar Vehi Titein, Tana Ahave, Mekayma Tana Ahave Azla, that she will give, meaning the get is hers now, she's Megureshet, she's divorced now, but she has to give the money that was agreed upon at some point in the future. Now, Eitan Diamond is asking, so according to Rav Huna, if they are married on the condition that he gives her the money sometime in the future, what happens if he never gives it to her? What if he dies before he gives it to her? Does that change the technical nature of their marriage? Does it mean that they were never married? Eitan, this, of course, is a very relevant question, and it is discussed in the Gemara, whether or not she may give the money, for instance, to he may give the money to her relatives, because after all, the money that he promised her is now an asset belonging to the woman, which would imply that the asset can be turned over to her relatives, her heirs, when she dies, and that retroactively, as soon as he gives the money to her heirs, she would be appropriately mikudeshet to him from the beginning because he fulfilled this condition. Or shall we say that this is only for her and not for the heirs? And this is a question that's discussed in the Gemara, and we will get to it, Eitan, as we move along. Anyway, moving back to our Gemara, in component number 6, we have Rav Huna Amar Vehi Titein Tana Ahave Mekayimat Tana V'Azla, that she's divorced now, but she has to give the money to him in the future as agreed. Rav Yudah Mar Lechashet Titein Lechi Yehivale Huda Havigit Hashtamiha Lo Havigit, that Rav Yudah would say that the only time she becomes divorced is when she gives him the agreed upon money. And therefore, that's when she will be divorced. But now it's not considered a get yet until she gives the money to him. And then in component number 7, we have the Nafkamina. Mai Benayu, what is the practical difference between them? Ika Benayu Shinit Kara Haget Osheavad, the Rav Huna Haveget, the Rav Yudah Lo Haveget. We would have a situation where the get would become torn or lost in between its being given and the money being given, what would the gerushin be effective? So according to Rav Huna, it would be effective because she has to give him the money sometime in the future, but the get is effective immediately. Whereas Rav Yudah would say the get is not effective until she gives the money, and therefore if it's lost or torn in the meantime, then it's not a get and the whole divorce is off. So we can see that component 1 is parallel to component 5, component 2 is parallel to component 6, and component 3 is parallel to component 7. 1 is parallel to 4, 2 is parallel to 6, 3 is three is parallel to 7. And if you look in Gittin, in the Sukkin Gittin, you have exactly the same thing, only in reverse order. Exactly the same sugya. Okay, now, at this point, the question that is still hanging in the air is, why do I need it to be brought to me twice? And as per our previous discussion, that it is not a transfer sugya, that meaning that it really did appear in two cases, the question of the Gemara is a question on the pshat. Why actually would I need Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda to discuss this on two separate occasions? So, the Gemara says, in component number 8, it says, Sriha, that there is good reason why this has to be said on more than one occasion. De'i ashma'inan gabi kiddushin, because if I would have learned this machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda in the case of kiddushin, of betrothal, taha kamar Rav Yehuda mishum de karuve ka'ate, and only it would be in kiddushin that Rav Huna would hold that it's effective immediately, because after all his purpose is to bring her close to him. Avo gerushin, but in the case of Gerushin, of Gittin, where he's coming to divorce her, and he wants her as far away as possible, as soon as possible, Ema Modele de Rav Yehuda. I would say that maybe in that case, that since he wants to Lerachekot, he would agree with Rav Yehuda that she has to give the money, and only then will the get be effective, because if it's effective right away, he'll have no way of collecting from her after she runs. Ve'id mar b'hach, and if there was a machlokin, b'hach kamar Rav Yehuda mishum de'iu lo ksif la lamitbea, because in Gittin, we might say that Rav Huna says what he says, that it's only effective when she gives him the money, because that the get is effective immediately, even before she gives the money, because since they're going to be divorced, he has no embarrassment to sue her for the money that is coming to him, and therefore the get can be effective right away. But in a case of marriage, of al hacha, in the case, our case of kiddushin, deihi ksifa leila mitbehe, that she would be embarrassed to sue him for the money, emamode leila Rav Yehuda tzricha, then I would say that Rav Huna would agree with Rav Yehuda that it should only be effective when he gives her the money, so that she won't be put in the position of having to sue him for the money in the course of the marriage. And therefore, since I would have had a reason to believe that the argument is only effective in one of the two places and not in the other, it was necessary for Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda to explicitly dispute the issue in both cases, so that I would know that the halacha is consistent in both cases according to both deot. And if I'm not mistaken, in Gittin, the tzrichuta also appears that the sugya is, again, continues to be a mirror image, one of the other. Now, the tzrichuta that we've just learned, of course, is a fixed argumentation pattern. It occurs in the Bavli with certain permutations almost 1,000 times. What I recommend is that you just mark on this tzrichuta the words that belong to the pattern, as opposed to the words that belong to the local case. The words of the pattern would be Utsricha, Dei Ashma Inan Gabe blank, Veha Ka'amar blank, Mishum De blank, Aval blank, Dile blank, Ema blank, Vei Itmar Behach, Veha Ka'amar blank, Mishum De blank, Aval Hacha De blank, Ema blank. Tzricha. Did you all get that? Now, this is what we're trying to do, is separate the actual algebraic pattern from the local topical material that is being inserted into the pattern, and this way we can learn to apply it in many other places in the Gemara. Okay, so what we've done in this sugya is as follows. Eitan is now asking, the Mai Benayu and the Tzricha arguments seem to be similar arguments. What is the difference between the two argument patterns? Okay, well, my benayu, ika benayu, is there to ask what is the practical halachic difference in application between the two opinions. Tzrichuta is not concerned with the practical application difference. It's asking for a svara that lies behind the arguments. It's more madua rather than lama. You see, in this case, what they're saying is that it's all based on, the reason why you needed two arguments is because of the emotional state of the man and the woman, not because of what may happen in the interval between the giving of the kiddushin and the giving of the get and the money being fulfilled. That's the issue of the nafka mina in the ika benayu, and the tzrichuta is dealing more with the svaras that lie behind the two cases. I hope, Eitan, that that's clarified it for you a little bit. I wanted to tell you all a story that happened to me this week on my travels in the Midwest. I happened to visit a school in St. Louis, the Epstein Academy in St. Louis, and I visited a seventh grade class that began our program in September. We're now in February. So the first 3 months of the year until the Chanukah time, they learned our skills booklet for the study of Mishnah and Torah Tanaim and completed it, knew it cold. I was amazed when I visited them at the end of November, the depth and the accuracy of their knowledge. And now, from the beginning of December until now, they had been studying Arvati Bartabam materials for the study of Gemara skills. And this seventh grade class, now in the middle of February, 3 months later, is now able to take sugyot they've never seen before, sort them by their components, Tanaim, Amuraim, and Shtama de Gemara, and understand what kind of sugya it is, and therefore know how to learn it independently. And their teacher is having difficulty believing what he is seeing. So it's always a pleasure to see schools coming along and teaching skills and methods that help students learn more effectively. Okay, let's continue now with the sugya, and we are in component number 9. We're continuing in the Stamma de Talmuda. There is no there's no clear statement in our sugya of who it is that's asking the question Meitivei, but generally speaking, Meitivei is considered to be a question by the Bnei Yeshiva. something posed by the participants in the yeshiva at whatever time. It's probably late 8th generation or Savoraic. And the Meitivei asks a question from a Braita. Hareza Gitecha Manachetit Nili Matayim Zuz. This is your get on the condition that you give me Matayim Zuz. Afal Pishanit Karaha Get Oshe Avad Harezu Migureshet Lacher Lo Tinase Achetitain. That the Gemara says, the Braita says, if a man says to a woman, this is your get on the condition that you give me 200 Zuz, that even though the get is torn or lost, she is nevertheless divorced. But she should not marry anyone else until she gives the money. In other words, that the Be'ikaradin, it's a good get from the time he gives it to her. It does not, its effectiveness does not depend on her giving the money. But she has to give the money in the future, and because she has to give it, the performance of the condition is important, and therefore, as an added measure of security, we don't allow her to marry anyone else until she actually gives the money to the one who divorced her. So this Baraita is obviously a support for Rav Huna and a caution Rav Yehuda, because Rav Yehuda said that the get will not be effective until the money is given, actually given. And whereas Rav Huna said the get will be effective immediately, but she has to give the money in the future. So here we have a Braita, which is challenging Rav Yehuda's opinion. And then the Gemara brings another Braita. Ve'od Tanya, Amar la hareza gitecha manachet pitnili matayim zuz ve'met. He said to her, this is your get on the condition to give me 200 zuz. And then he dies, presumably before she gives the money. Natana ein zkukali avam. If she gave the money, she doesn't require levirate marriage with his brother. Lo natna zkukali avam. But if she didn't give the money, then she does require levirate marriage. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, notenet le'echav, o le'aviv, o le'echav min ha'kruvim. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says she can give the money that she was supposed to give him. She may give it to his brothers or to his father or to one of the relatives, even after his death, because he had an asset, which was a receivable from her, and he passes that on to his Yorshin, to his heirs, and they may collect it from her. Now, in this second Baraita, who is the Kashan? The second Baraita seems to imply that she must give the money to him for the get to be effective, because if she doesn't give the money, then she has to have levirate marriage with the brother, which of course could not happen if she was considered divorced. So it would appear that here we have a stira to Rav Huna. But comes immediately the Gemara in component number 9 Gimel and says no, it's not a stira to Rav Huna. It's also still a question on Rav Yehuda. Why? Ad kan lo plige, says the Gemara. In this argument, the second Baraita, there is no argument. Ela de mor savar liva lo liyorshai, or mor savar afilu liyorshai. That one holds that the money may be given on to him or to his heirs, and one holds it may only be given to him and not to the heirs. Tekuli alma miha tana havai. But everyone holds that it's a get now, but the money has to be given afterwards. That the get is effective now. So it turns out that the Gemara understands this not as a stira to Rav Huna, but as a support for Rav Huna. That because what is the Braita saying? It's saying that we have an internal argument whether or not she may fulfill her condition by giving the money only to him, or she may also give to his relatives, to his Yorshim. But everyone agrees that it's a tanai that he has to give over that she has to give him the money over the period of time. So therefore, that's also Rav Huna. So it turns out that both Baraitot, according to the Gemara, are kashas on Rav Yehuda and supports for Rav Huna. How does the and therefore the Gemara says tiyuvta to Rav Yehuda? It would appear that this is a disproof of Rav Yehuda. So comes Rav Yehuda and says Amar lach Rav Yehuda. Of course, it's not really Rav Yehuda speaking, because it says Amar lach, which means Rav Yehuda would say to you. As if he would be able to, he would say to you now, Ha manhi, who is the source? Who is the source of the Brayta? Ribhi. These Braytot are according to the opinion of Rav Yehuda Nasi. De Amar Rav Huna Amar Ribi, as we know that Rav Huna said in the name of Rebbe, Kol HaOmer Amanat Ki Omer Me'achshav Tameh, that anyone who says a certain thing will be on the condition, Amanat, that really his intention is that what he's saying should be effective immediately with his declaration, but that the condition has to be fulfilled at some time in the future. V'pligi Rabbanan Alei, and so this voice answering in Rav Yehuda's name says that the rabbis, the Chachamim, disagreed with Rebbe on this point. V'ana de'amarei k'Rabbanan, and I say like the Chachamim. So in other words, that it turns out that the machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda in Kiddushin and on Gittin, brought in our sukkah, that they are dependent upon an earlier Tana'itic dispute between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi holds that it's a Tanai, that it's effective immediately, but that the payment has to be given in the future. But whereas Rabbi Yehuda holds like the Chachamim, and they hold, not like Rebbe, that it's only effective when the money is actually given. And therefore, our sugya ends up with saying that we really have a machloket tanaim here, not a machloket amuraim, brought twice, once in Gittin and once in Kiddushin, but we actually have a tanaitic dispute. And this is very problematic, because if it's a tanaitic dispute, then we would have assumed that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, instead of bringing their own opinions on this, simply would have said, this is a machloket tanaim, and Rav Huna says like Rebbe, and Rav Yehuda says like the Chachamim. Why does the Gemara venture to give me a machloket amoraim on two separate occasions, if really it's a machloket tanaim? And we have to remember that Rav Yehuda did not say this himself, that this explanation, this is brought by the Stamma de Gemara. The Stamma de Gemara comes and says that it's really a machloket tanaim and not a machloket of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda originally. And this, of course, is going to have to be dealt with, because it can't remain this way for the Gemara to come to the conclusion that there's really a Tanaitic dispute and without the Amoraim having been brought without awareness. And this is where this sugya comes to a close. And you can see that in this sugya, a very small percentage of the sugya, maybe 10% of the sugya, is Amoraic, and all the balance of the sugya comes from the Shaka Vataria, from the Stamma de Gemara. So I would ask you, is this sugya an Amoraic sugya, or is this a Stamma sugya, and why? Please respond through using your microphones, or by answering me through the chat room what you feel. Is this an Amoraic sugya, or is it a Stamma sugya? And tell me why. So I'm waiting for your responses. Amoraic sugya or Stamma sugya, and why? Does everyone out there understand the difference between the Stamma sugya and an Amoraic sugya? Eitan Diamond for Toronto suggests that it's a Stamma sugya because it seems to be cobbling together opinions. Okay. And Yisrael Kashkin for Pasek is asking, no, what is the difference between a Stamma and Amoraic sugya? The sugya that developed during the period of the Amoraim between 220 and 500, where the Amoraim are presented in chronological sequence, that they are the base of the sugya, and the Stamma de Gemara adds itself on top of a pre-existing Amoraic sugya. That's an Amoraic sugya. A Stamma sugya is a sugya that develops only late. It develops after the Amoraic period, and if it includes Amoraim, they're being quoted into the lecture context of the Stamma de Gemara. So the question is here, did the Stamma come on top of an Amoraic sugya that was already in existence, or did the Stamma just give a lecture, and it quoted Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda? Tuvia from Miami says that it's a Stamma because it is left with the question, why didn't they begin with Tanaitic opinions? And Yisrael Kashkin's answer here is not clear. He says, I would say it, and he doesn't finish. So you have a doubt. Oh, so he says it's Amoraic because it does cite two strong divergent opinions. Okay, so I suppose it's my obligation to Israel says, oh, even though it leaves it very vague. Well, I suppose it's my responsibility here to determine what exactly it is. And the answer is that this is an Amoraic sugya with a lot of stoma, like Byron says from Toronto. Absolutely correct. Because if you take all the stoma out of this sugya, take it all out, all 90% out, what you're left with is the machloket of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, meaning that there is Amoraic material that is local on the Mishnah and relevant to the Mishnah, even without all of the stoma de Gemara. This indicates that it's an Amoraic sugya. And since there are no Amoraic pieces that are brought out of sequence here, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda lived at the same time, we have no reason for saying that this is a stoma sugya. Remember, my friends, that it is not an issue of quantity. It's an issue of structure. You can have a sugya stoma, and it would be a stoma sugya, and you can have a sugya like ours, which is 10% amoraim and 90% stoma, and it's an amoraic sugya. There is absolutely no connection between the quantitative contribution of amoraim versus stoma to the identity of the sugya itself. And therefore, it's very important for us to scan, pre-scan sugyas that we're going to learn, see their structure, identify what kind of sugya it is, because remember that if it's an Amoraic sugya, we have to learn the Amoraim first and the Stoma second. And if it's a Stoma sugya, we have to learn the Stoma first and the Amoraim second. So, it's 90% Stoma, that all of the Stoma is based on the Amoraic kernel that was there before it, which is the machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. And therefore we have an Amoraic sugya with lots of Stoma. Eitan is now asking, why didn't the Stoma cite the Rav Huna, Rav Yehuda statement, it's by itself. Why didn't the Stoma cite why does it disguise its question in the name of Rav Yehuda rather than being posed by the Stoma itself? I don't understand your question, Eitan. What exactly are you referring to? Why didn't the Stoma cite the last Rav Huna, Rav Yehuda statement by itself? Why does it disguise its question in the name of Rav Yehuda rather than being posed by the Stoma? Eitan says it seems to disguise the statement as a hypothetical question by Rav Yehuda. Eitan, I don't understand what you're referring to. Please tell me what lines you're referring to and clarify your statement. It's not clear to me what you're talking about. Do other participants understand what Eitan is saying? Gil is saying, after the shir, would it be possible to send the explanation of stoma and amoraic via email? Thank you. Yes, Gil, what I would like you to do then is send me an email to bonayich, bonayich, at 012.net.il, and then I will respond. Send your question by email, and I will respond to you. Eitan says we shouldn't worry about it, we should go on. Okay. Yisrael is saying it's because it's an Amoraic statement. It's not disguising anything. The Amoraic statement is speaking for itself. Yes, I think that's true, Yisrael, that Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are being presented as Amoraic statements straight up. We call this an independent memra because it starts with the word Itamar. And then the additions of the Stama are what they are. Okay, I think we've... And Eitan said you meant number 9D1. Oh, that one. Amar lach Rav Yehuda. Ha'amani Rav Yehuda. Ah, yes, that's definitely stoma. There's no doubt that is stoma, Eitan. That doesn't impact on the authenticity, the Amoraic authenticity of the memras that are brought at the beginning of the sugya. So, the stoma will often include a continuation of a dispute by Amoraim with Amar lach. But that doesn't mean that the opinions themselves are stoma. Okay, does that clarify for you, Eitan? Okay. But why put it in Rav Yehuda's voice? Why not raise the question outright? Oh, that's the reason why is that when the Meitave brought the two Braitot that seemed to challenge Rav Yehuda, that puts Rav Yehuda in a negative position. So the stoma is always, it's the way of the stoma to answer on behalf of the one who is challenged by the Braitot. But in order that we should not be mixed up to think that it's actually the Amora speaking, the Gemara presents it as Amar Lach Ploni, that Rav Ploni would say as follows to you, so that you're aware that it's not him speaking, it's the stomach conjecturing what he would have said had he been asked. Okay? That's why it's put in Rav Yehuda's name, but it's put in his name with an Amar Lach, so we will not make the error of thinking that actually he is the one who is speaking. Okay. Let us move on to sugya number 5. If you could all turn to sugya number 5 in your pages, we'll move on. And I hope we'll have a chance to finish this before today's lesson concludes. Here, our Gemara, once it is brought in the end of sugya number 4, it's brought the machloket between Rebbe and the Chachamim, or a supposed machloket between Rebbe and the Chachamim, onto which Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda can hang their opinions. The Gemara goes back and quotes this, quotes a sugya that deals with this statement of Rav Huna in the name of Rebbe, that kol ha'omer almanat ki omer me'achshav dami. You see that in component number 1 in sugya number 5. And Rav Huna, do you all know who Rav Huna was? Rav Huna was the head of the academy in Sura in the second generation. He was a Talmud of Rav, and from Rav he received the Torah of Rebbe. I don't think Rav Huna ever personally met Rebbe. He never was in Eretz Yisrael during his lifetime, to the best of my knowledge. He didn't learn from Rebbe, and therefore it's a bit odd that we have Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rebbe, because how can Rav Huna say directly in the name of an Amora that he did not learn from? So there are girsaot that say Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav, not Rebbe. Now that would make perfectly good sense, because Rav Huna can't certainly say in the name of Rav, who was his personal mentor. Okay, in any event, the component number 1 says, Kol ha'omer almanat ki omer me'achshav dame. Another reason why it's likely that it's Amar Rav and not Amar Rebbe, because it quotes it as a memra, Rav Huna, that Rav Huna taught in the name of Rebbe, using a Tanaitic quotation pattern, and therefore it's very likely that it's Rav and not Rebbe. In any event, in response to this, Amar Rebbe Zera, Rebbe Zera said, and Rebbe Zera that we're talking about here is the second Rebbe Zera, who is a third generation Babylonian Amora, a Talmud of Rav Yehuda, who left Rav Yehuda to go learn in Tveria by Rabbi Yochanan. He's part of the entire group of Babylonian Amoraim that in the third generation made Aliyah in order to learn with Rabbi Yochanan. And look at this fascinating story that he tells us. He says, Amar Rabbi Zera, Rabbi Zera said, Ki havinan bibavel, when we were still in Bavel, when we lived back in Bavel before we came here on Aliyah, Hava Amrinan, we used to say, Hadi Amar Rav Huna Amar Rav Amar Rebbe, Kol HaOmer Almanat Ki Omer Me'achshav Dame, that what Rebbe said, that anyone who says Almanat is referring to immediate effectivity of the statement, Pligi Rabbanan Alei, that there's an argument that Rebbe says this, but the Chachamim disagree with him. And then Rabbi Zera continues and says, Ki Salaki Lahatam, but when I came up to there, when I came up to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel, Ashkechei l'Ravi Asi diatev v'ka'amar la mishmei de Rabbi Yochanan, that he says that then when I came up to Israel, I found Rabbi Asi, who was another member of the Babylonian club living in Tveria, and he was a very prominent student of Rabbi Yochanan by this time. He finds Rabbi Asi sitting and saying this in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that Hakol Modim be'omer almenat Ke Omer Me'achshav Dami, that everyone, Rebbe and the Chachamim, everybody agrees that when someone says Almanat, they mean Me'achshav. They mean that it will be effective immediately. Lo Nechleku Ela Mehayom Uleachar Mita. That the dispute was not about Me'achshav, the language of Me'achshav. The dispute was only about the language of Mehayom Uleachar Mita. V'hatanya, Mehayom uleachar mita get ve'eino get divrei chachamim ribi omer kazeh get. And here the word dehatanya is benihuta, meaning not to bring akasha, but to say, and we have this in a braita, that here is a braita that says that on the usage of the terms mehayom uliachar mita, that the Chachamim say it's a doubtful get, and Rebbe says it is a get. So you see that the machloket was not at all in me'achshav uliachar mita. Me'achshav, kol ha'omer me'achshav is really ki'omer mehayom. As Rav Huna quoted in the name of Rav or Rebbe. So if this is the case, then now we're thrown back to a very interesting situation, because Rabbi Zera is giving us testimony to the fact that in Babel they have a mistaken impression of what was the machloket between the Chachamim and Rebbe. They thought that the machloket was in Me'achshav. And we know now it's not Me'achshav, it's Me'hayom Lochamita. How does this impact on the previous sugya? It means that the entire escape route that the Gemara, the Stam of the Gemara, the Babylonian Stam of the Gemara, provided for Rabbi Yehuda, this escape route is now closed. Because we wanted to say in the name of Rav Huna that he holds like the Chachamim, that Me'achshav is not effective immediately, but only when the condition is fulfilled. But now we know that everyone, all the Tanaim, agree that Me'achshav means it's effective immediately before the condition is fulfilled, and therefore Rabbi Yehuda has no one to rely on, no Tana that he can hang his hat on, whereas Rav Huna has a tradition going back to Rebbe, which says that Me'achshav means effective now. So, at this point in our sugya, Rav Yehuda is back in trouble. He has no Tanaitic support against Rav Huna, who does have Tanaitic support. So what do we do with this? So the Gemara says in component number 3, "U le Rav Yehuda diamar be'almena nami plige, adami palge be'mehayom ule chamita ni palge be'almenat." And according to Rav Yehuda, who held, or at least according to the Stam of the Gemara held, that there's a machloket between Rebbe and the Chachamim also in the uses of the term me'achshav, why don't we have them arguing in almenat as opposed to mehayom uleachar mita? So the Gemara answers to this question on Rav Yehuda, lo diacha koach de Rebbe, de mehayom uleachar mita nami harezeket, because the Braita is trying to teach us just how extreme is Rebbe's position, that even with the phraseology of mehayom uleachar mita, which is doubtful to the Chachamim, and even in that case he holds that the get is effective. So the Gemara says, if you want to tell us that the Braita is formulated in order to teach the extremity of one position, so let it be formulated to teach me the extremity of another position. So why not teach it, the Braita in Almanat, and say that there's an argument in there too, and that the Chachamim, even in Almanat, say it's not a good. And the answer is, Koach Tehetera Adif. Because if you have to choose between proving the extremity of opinion 1 or opinion 2, you choose the demonstration of the extremity of the position, which is more mekel, because koach teheitera adif. And with this sugya comes to a close. Now, what do we learn from this sugya? Here, the separation of the Amoraic material from the Stam of the Gemara is critical, because if you look carefully, you'll see that on the level of the Amoraic material itself, all we have is the opinions of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, and this story in the previous sugya, and in this sugya, all we have is the statement of Rav Huna in the name of Rebbe that Kol Haomer Amanat Ki Omer Me'achshav Dami, and Rabbi Zera comes to say that everyone agrees with this. It's not just a statement of Rebbe, the Chachamim also agree. The argument is only Mehayom Uliachar Mita. This puts Rav Yehuda in an exceptionally tenuous position, because we have a Tanaitic proof for the opinion of Rav Huna, and Rav Yehuda is left all alone. So how can that be? So this is why the Stam of the Gemara comes and explains that in Bavel they held, that, or at least it presumes that Rav Yehuda held, that the machloket is not only in Mehayom Luchamita, the machloket is also in Me'achshav. And therefore, Rav Yehuda would be able to depend upon the opinion of the Chachamim against Rebbe in order to maintain his position in the argument. And therefore, the addition of the Stama basically makes all right in the world again, with both Amoraim having Tanaitic opinions on which to base themselves. The minute you remove the stomach from the sugya, we end up with a sugya that supports Rav Huna and leaves Rav Yehuda in a very, very difficult place. Now, Yisrael Kashkin from Passaic is asking, sugya 5 proves that sugya 4 was Amoraic because they Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda continue their argument. Well, in sugya 5, we don't have a machloket between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. We have a statement of Rav Huna and Rabbi Zera saying that when he got to Israel, he realized that this was not only in the name of Rebbe, but in the name of the Chachamim also. But we don't have any conclusion here in the Amoraic level in sugya number 5 about Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda is only mentioned in sugya number 5 in the stama level. Okay, do you understand? Do you see that? You may nod your head. Okay, very good. So now we have these two sugyot which really go together, and you see here the importance of separating the Amoraic material from the stama. For those of you that are new with us and you want to try to do this on your own, which I'd recommend you do on any sugya that you're learning, to try to separate Amoraic sources from stama de Gemara in order to appreciate more sharply what it is the stama de Gemara is adding to the Amoraic material. I recommend that you do that. And how do you separate it? You look for sources that have names. The sources that are brought by the names of the Amoraim, those are Meimrot, and the anonymous sources are the Stama de Gemara. Separate these into two groups. Check the Amoraic sources to see if they're presented in chronological sequence. And then, if they are, then it's an Amoraic sugya, and you learn the Amoraim first and the Stama second. And if not, then you learn the Stama first and the Amoraim as quotations within it. Gil, what you say, sorry, I lost it. What did you lose? Please tell me what you lost, and we'll try to find it for you. Gil, are you there? What have you lost? Or if there are any other questions from anyone, please, from out there in cyberspace. So Yisrael is asking, so what is the Amora's goal in Sukkah 4? To Paskin? Yes, of course. In Sukkah 4, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are Paskining from, based on the Mishnah, whether or not the get or the kiddush will be effective immediately or only when the condition is fulfilled. That's a clear psak halacha. And all of the commentary of the Stama is to analyze the Svara. This is the main purpose of Amoraic teaching, is to Paskin. That's exactly right. So why would they give so little information about the basis of the disagreement? That's because the Meimrot of the Amoraim were, you notice they're in Hebrew and they're very terse, because they were learned by heart by the students, just like Mishnayot and Braitot. And therefore they had to be kept very short, just the Psak Halacha itself. In the same way the Mishnah doesn't give us Svarot for its Piskei Din, and Bright don't give us Svarot for their Piskei Din, the Amoraim don't give us Svarot for their Piskei Din. They just give us their names and their final Psak. Okay, Gil says that when you saw mentioned sugya 4 and 5, I only see on the sheet is number 3. No, number 3 is the sugya, is the previous sugya. We learned it 2 weeks ago. We're on sugya 4 and sugya 5, which is what we learned today. Okay, Israel, is that clear to you now, that the whole purpose of the Meimrot is to Paskin, and the Svaras we have to look for in the Stama de Gemara? Okay, are there any further questions from anyone? Yisrael says the approach makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much. Well, it's not mine. It's the approach of the Rishonim and the Achronim. They all learn this way. The fact that it's not being taught this way today in yeshivas is simply by neglect. It's not. There's no other reason for it. It's not that there are different opinions about whether the Stama de Gemara is a wrapper on top of the Amoraim. Everybody held this, and I don't really understand why in yeshivas they don't teach it, because it makes a lot of sense and it makes it a lot easier for students, because once you separate the Amoraim from the stama digmara, you have concrete thinking on the amoraic level and conceptual thinking on the stama level, and students of different ages and abilities can therefore progress in an orderly manner from more simple thinking, concrete thinking, to conceptual and abstract thinking when they're ready. Makes it much more difficult and easy. Difficult because you have to know more about the participants, and easier because not just a mishmash, easy to grasp the concepts. That's right, Yisrael. A prerequisite for using this shita is learning a certain basic amount about who the Amoraim were, at which generations, in which Batei Midrash, approximately 30 names, and that enables you then to do this kind of exercise. And so there's a little bit of work at the beginning, but it's a lot easier later. Yes, Gil, when you send me an email, I'll explain about separating the Amoraim from the Stama. And Gil, if you wish, and others who would like to learn more about this, you can go into the MP3 library on the Torah in Motion website and see my initial lectures where I explain all of this fully. So you will not only get an email from me, you can also see me explaining it on film. So go into the MP3 library under the lectures given by myself, and you'll see there the ones that explain the shita and how to use it, and that will bring you up to speed for next week's lesson when we plan to go on to sugya number 6, which is in Kiddushin Daf Samech Hamud Bet. If you do not have the Rivadim sheets, you write me an email and I will send them to you, and we will continue at that time. If you have any questions in the course of the week, I am again putting my email address on the screen, and I am more than happy to get emails from you at all times with questions about the method or about any specific sugya. Also, I recommend the Torah in Motion website. You take a look and you'll see the list of Amoraim on the website, and that enables you to, if you want to print that, you can then follow our analysis of who is who and when as we learn. Okay, well, this is our study for today, and unless there are any other questions, I'm going to sign off from Port Columbus and be on my way to Atlanta, and I will broadcast next week from Muncie, New York, to you again. And Yisrael, why just 30 names? There are really over 1,400 Amoraim, but it's these 30 names, approximately 30 names, are the ones that occur all the time. And therefore, if you know them, you can get through most sukkiyot independently. Okay, be well. Have a good week, everyone, and we look forward to seeing you next week, same time, same station, on the Torah in Motion Broadcasting Network. Bye-bye.